we present the News Quiz with your host, Sandy Toksvig.
Hello and welcome to the News Quiz. We start with a BBC.co.uk news report on three new nuclear submarines, read by Peter Donaldson.
A huge red neon sign reminds the workforce the first one is now just 32 days away from launch. But to judge by the scaffolding surrounding it, it's hard to believe it's going to be ready on time. I am determined it will be, says Operations Director Nigel Ward. However, it's a nuclear submarine, and lots of things can go wrong.
And our thanks to everyone in the world for sending that in. Now, let's meet the teams. Will you welcome first on my right, Francis Ween and Simon Evans. And opposite them on my left, Alan Corran and Andy Hamilton. Question number one, Francis, have a listen to this.
Is it Patricia Hewitt? John Prescott has resigned as Deputy Prime Minister, or is going to. Is that right? I watched it live on telly, his very moving address from Trimden Labour Club. But it's very odd, because I was watching it, and before he came on stage, they were working themselves up into a state of absolute ecstasy, these people. This was just as their hero was about to announce his resignation and singing, "Things can only get better." Seems slightly ungrateful, really, since they're all his fans, but there we are. He came on and said, "Sorry." So that was about the only first thing about it, because he has been announcing his resignation, well, since the News Quiz was done by candlelight in the last days of the Heath government, I think.
You say grateful, and I would like to thank him personally, because June the 27th is my birthday. And I think this is an enormously generous gift. A pair of socks would have done.
But Blair, according to sources, is going to promote harmony among all the religions of the world.
He's that's a hairspray, isn't it?
Teach harmony. The world to sing. In perfect harmony and but build the world a home and furnish it with love and apple trees and
honeybees. Snow white turtle doves. Well, new labour, new seekers. There's a great quote on Today programme, Neil Kinnock. He said, "When I think of Tony Blair, I automatically think of one word." And I thought, well, we all do that.
I wasn't fully listening, and he said he'd had the honour of leading the greatest nation on earth. And I thought, is it Prime Minister of Denmark? Yes, indeed, America's Tony, has announced that he will stand down as Prime Minister on Alan Corran's birthday after the Labour Party elect a new leader. During the speech, he said history will be the judge of him, and others hope it will be someone from the International Court of Human Rights. Simon, welcome to the show again. Who put their troubles behind them this week?
Oh, this is a good start. I can't think what you're possibly referring to there.
The troubles.
The Northern Ireland story. Okay. You didn't pronounce the capital T. Yes, this is, I suppose, an Easter bank holiday Monday to follow the Good Friday Agreement of about 9 years ago. It's been quite a long, drawn-out bank holiday weekend, but then they often are. So, obviously, the process got caught in traffic somewhere. Although it was useful to see Ian Paisley and Patrick Moore on the news on the same day, which has cleared up a suspicion I've had for some time. Two dandruffy brethren.
Paisley was rather wonderful, because although he was being all nice and well-behaved, he then went into his old biblical riff. There is a time for war and a time for peace, a time for hate and a time for love. I thought, how does he work out which time is which? I imagine this huge year planner in his office. And says, sorry, I can't do August, that's the marching season, that's the time.
What I thought was really touching about the story, though, were the pictures of them kind of joking and laughing. And it made you wonder how many world conflicts could be resolved if the people involved just actually met. Do you think 30 years from now we'll be watching footage of Osama bin Laden and George Bush with Osama saying, "Well, you know, once I got to know him, he's actually quite a nice bloke." The other thing that struck me was I saw these fantastic photographs of Ian Paisley really laughing and Martin McGuinness laughing, and then I saw the footage in the news of them chatting, and they're obviously sharing a joke. And I thought, what would be the joke that would unite Martin McGuinness? It can't be an Englishman, Scotsman, and Irishman. It must presumably be a Jewish joke. That's the only thing it could have been, isn't it?
It's extraordinary, though. I mean, Paisley and McGuinness together. I was trying to put it in perspective. director for something. I said, it's a bit like me presenting the news quiz with Richard Littlejohn. It has a similar kind of feel to it.
Well, he's very nice once you get to meet him.
I will miss the expression the troubles, though. That's just sounded so much nicer than war, isn't it? It's kind of...
You say it now from here on in, it's the banality, isn't it? Which is just much less
interesting. It's very strange. Yeah. I'm 30 times older than anybody here. And when I grew up, my mother and her friends referred to the troubles as what periods were. And I never really understood why it caused such a fuss in Ireland.
I think if they'd said the Irish have got the painters in for 30 years...
Moving on, it was a historic, thank you, Radio 4, it was an historic week in Northern Ireland, which saw the return of government to Stormont as Sinn Féin and the unionists agreed to power sharing at last, bringing the Troubles to an end. And the two old enemies, Ian Paisley and Martin McGuinness, agreed to work with each other. McGuinness helped Paisley find his megaphone, and Paisley helped him paint a lovely mural in his new office. Andy, which new premier is Duc en Mer?
Oh, this is Sarkozy, is it?
Yeah.
It's a lovely name, isn't it? Sarkozy. Sounds like a little woolen cover that you put on a Russian monarch to keep him warm. Now this is going to be really interesting because we don't know how right-wing this chap is. It's all a bit vague. He has a reputation in the past for occasionally calling people scum and things like that, and being quite a hardliner, but he's talking about, now he's going to be a bit more conciliatory, but he's already hit his first scandal because he's taken a holiday at the home of a prominent businessman. And you think, has he learnt nothing from Tony Blair whatsoever?
It's sort of irrelevant how right-wing he is in a way, because you only have to be a little bit right-wing in France to trigger the blockading of the ports and the lorry drivers up and down, and it all shuts down anyway, and they continue to exist on charm and subsidy.
The left act like that. The left are extraordinary. You meet left-wing farmers in France who treat their trucks like tanks. They're very odd, the French. They are all extremely right-wing, but they have a gloss of left about it. So as soon as you actually announce yourself to be a slightly right-of-centre candidate, the left come out and behave like the Waffen-SS.
What was impressive, though, was, 85% of the electorate turned out to vote. For us to do that, it would have to be live on ITV, involve show tunes, and we'd have to text our votes in.
But also, the difference on this one was that, if you remember, when in 1997, when Blair came to power, there were all these threats from various showbiz stars, in inverted commas, that they would flee the country if Labour got in to go into tax exile, which is what swept Labour to power, I think, the prospect. maybe Jim Davidson, Andrew Lloyd Webber will go and leave. Whereas in Sarkozy's case, Johnny Hallyday said, I'll come back and live in France if you vote Sarkozy. And it worked the other way around. They all voted for Sarkozy.
Yes, indeed, French president-elect Nicolas Sarkozy has caused outrage by taking a 3-day luxury cruise at the expense of one of France's wealthiest businessmen. Mr. Sarkozy campaigned for a France that values hard work. That'll be a fictional France, then. Alan!
We're really doing our bit for the entente cordiale There'll be a war on Monday, and it'll be Alan's fault, and you'll be the other name on the indictment.
I'm not worried. I've got a holiday home in Denmark, greatest country in the world. Alan's, I seem to recall, is in France. No, Alan. Where should sexual discrimination be bedded in?
It's about ward sharing in our NHS hospitals. As there are very few wards, it's about trolley sharing, which is a bit terrifying. You don't want to get on a trolley with an octogenarian incontinent of either sex in the middle of a night and it all starts shaking a bit. There are no nurses, and you and the trolley are out there going down King's Road at hell of a clip before you know it. It's about segregation and non-segregation.
There was a lovely headline about Patricia Hewitt on this. It said, Hewitt admits failure on mixed sex pledge. Hunted up a picture that really only Hieronymus Bosch, I think, could probably do justice to it.
I said it last, they cut it out last year. I should keep on saying it until they keep it in. What you don't know, Patricia Hewitt is the first wife of James Hewitt and the mother of Prince Harry. That is why she is kept in office. She knows people.
I've heard that.
Yeah, you've heard that.
Yeah.
We both have.
I did read that. I think they've managed to get maternity wards to be almost entirely single-sex now.
That's coming along nicely.
Yes, absolutely.
Last year, health ministers reported that 99% of patients were being seen in single-sex wards. A report from the Healthcare Commission has revealed that this oddly enough, is not the case. In fact, it's more like 75%, which is a very similar number. The Health Secretary, Patricia Hewitt, was accused... Sorry, can I get my adenoid seen too? Health Secretary Patricia Hewitt was accused of burying this news by releasing it the day before Blair's big resignation announcement. Asked to respond, she replied, "Did you hear that Tony was leaving?" And at the end of round one, the scores are Francis and Simon have got 5, and so have Alan and Andy. Round two with a cutting from the Independent's TV listings.
BBC One, 11:55. Film, Disturbing Behaviour. Director, David Nutter.
Thanks to everyone who sent us that. Francis, who thinks that all work and no play makes Jack an efficient pupil?
This is a very sinister character indeed. He's the head of a new flagship school, a city academy in Peterborough, which has cost, I think, 46 million quid. Mm. And although they've spent 46 million quid on it, and it opens in the autumn, it hasn't got a playground. And the reason for this is that it's not going to have any playground, or indeed any break times, because the head, Mr. Wackford Squeers... He's actually called Alan McMurdo. I heard him interviewed on the radio, and he was sort of grad grind and Squeers rolled into one. He was a terrifying figure. He said, when he's asked about the lack of playgrounds and break times, he said, "We do not believe in that concept." Concept. I don't know why he says it's a concept, but apparently they're just going to work like Billy-O and then fall to bits, because they're not allowed to let off steam. He says, if children are working all day long, they don't need to let off steam.
And he says,
makes you wonder how long he's been a teacher, this chap.
Yeah, or whether he's ever met one child. But he said that they won't need playtime because they'll be so fantastically stimulated by the lessons. Mm. Or he didn't call them lessons, he calls them the learning experience.
And he said if they need a refreshment break, they can have a sip of water during the lesson, or as he put it, they can hydrate during the learning experience.
It is, it's very distressing to think of children being brought up in Peterborough, you know, and...
Yes, it is the new £46 million Thomas Deacon Academy in Peterborough, the most expensive state school in the UK. It will not have a playground area, or as one of the project managers called it, uncontrollable space, in order to maximise the learning potential of pupils or scholastic end-user units. 2 points, Francis. Andy, which head of state was a reluctant dinner date?
I felt a bit sorry for George Bush, actually. It's not a sentence I've ever used before. Because there was all this stuff about some gaffe that he made, and I tuned in gleefully, thinking, oh, this would be some hilarious thing that would live eternally on YouTube. But all it was that he said 1796 instead of 1976.
He accidentally implied the Queen was 200. When she's definitely nearer 300.
Yeah. But why is she reluctant dinner date? Didn't she want to go? Did they?
No, he was reluctant because his bedtime is 9 p.m. Mm. True. And he's never, in all the time he's been president, had an official dinner that goes on after 9 p.m. He's never had a full-scale white tie, well, five course.
But he has to go up to bed at 9 because otherwise there isn't time for his story.
Wonderful thought, isn't it, really? I mean, Bush and his TV dinners and this enormous state banquet. There's a huge plasma screen showing the little house on the prairie all the time so he can eat. Otherwise, he won't be able to.
I thought it was a shame that Prince Philip and George W. Bush didn't go head-to-head in a big gaff-off, really.
Queen's visit to the United States culminated in the first white tie, five-course White House banquet of Bush's presidency after his wife persuaded him that it was a good idea. Apparently, when Bush first met the Queen in 1991, he asked her who the black sheep was in her family, and apparently she's now got it down to a short list of 3.
It's Patricia Hewitt.
Alan, here's a bit of music for you.
Thank heaven for little girls. Thank heaven for them all, no matter where, no matter who. Without them, what would little boys do?
Who thinks we've more than enough females in broadcasting?
Well, this is the amazing
one-eyed yellow god. This is Patrick Moore, the man with a soup plate in his eye, the slightly crazy cricketer, always wears an RAF tie, which I find really quite engaging. Let me say, stand Hunter's Moon tonight. Not the ball-bearing works that Schwein fought again. slightly lives in the past, I think. But really rather nice man for someone who knows very, very little about astronomy. And basically, what you want... He's the man who gave Uranus a bad name. Now, he comes on with a pumpkin and says, this is the sun, and then the pea is the moon, and then you've got a split pea, which... That's his kind of astrology. You do it with a knitting needle, shove through an orange. And it's my kind of astronomy, too. And I might have said astrology there, but it doesn't really matter. Because Patrick Moore believes it, whatever it is. And what he really believes is that the BBC is being run by women, and it's a very bad thing because there's nothing except makeover programmes and what's in your attic. And
well, he especially said quizzes chaired by women.
By I think he's running as the well. Women executives, the Jenny O'Brien.
No, he said these jokey women chairing quizzes. I can't be doing that.
You know, I say Danish women. I saw Danish women.
But he's right, because you remember when Alan and I started doing the news quiz 50 years ago, when Patrick Moore started the Sky at Night, it was half an hour of Alvar Liddell reading out the court circular. It was so much better than this.
Well, I agree with him entirely. 84-year-old Sir Patrick Moore, 84, has accused British TV standards of deteriorating because the BBC is run by women, male presenters have been replaced with less competent women, and programming has taken a female-orientated slant. Absurd.
He didn't want women in Doctor Who. I mean, who's going to trip at the end of the episode and be in danger?
What he said was, it was okay to have a spaceship that can travel faster than the speed of light, it was okay to have a crew populated by aliens, but having a woman as the captain, that's pure fantasy.
And the amazing thing is, he has never been taught to play the xylophone. He's entirely self-taught. Can you imagine what sort of temperament walks into a room where there's a xylophone and four sticks with cherries on the end and says, I could play that, and then teaches himself an instrument that nobody wants to listen to? Really? Really bizarre.
You have to do something with the daylight hours, you know.
A quick supplementary. Contrary to Sir Patrick, who finds the female of the species rewarding?
Men do. Men get a reward in their brain.
Men lust after pictures of women more than women lust after pictures of men.
Well, women don't... Well, it's not so much lust. Men get pleasure from looking at women, well, whereas women get no enjoyment from looking at men.
Don't get all pernickety with me. We know what we're talking about, Francis.
Apparently, in the male brain, there are these things called reward centres. For a man, every time he looks at a woman, it's a reward, and they pile up in his brain.
It's like a nectar card.
On his card, yeah, exactly. And eventually, when he's collected enough reward points, he can buy himself a cold shower and calm down again.
Apparently it's the same pleasure that men get looking at women as enjoying a curry.
Yes. Yeah. Just before you get cocky about it, though, it's the men's brains that's the point, not the female bodies, because gay men get the same reward centres lit up when they look at other men. Lesbians don't get the same reward centres lit up when they look at
other men. So it's really a story about women's brains being defective.
Yes.
Well, if it's in the newspaper, you can't really come on.
Well, a study has revealed that looking at photos of women triggers the reward centre in a man. It's not what we called it in my day. At the end of round two, Alan and Andy have got 9 points, but Francis and Simon have got 10. Before we start round three, here is a cutting from the Manchester Evening News.
A group of balloonists is trapped in the Syrian desert after police confiscated their equipment. One of the group, Rupert Evelyn, said the group had been sitting in the desert for 3 days waiting to see whether they'll be reunited with their balloons. He said, everything's up in the air at the moment.
And thanks to all those who sent that in. Francis, which biblical bad boy has just been brought to light?
King Herod.
Indeed.
It's either him or Patricia Hewitt. And I think it's King Herod. They say they found his tomb. Actually, there's a slight Blairite tinge to this story, because there are pieces saying that the legacy, that history has in it, all because the Gospels did him down and said he went around slaughtering the firstborn and wasn't very nice. That's been his legacy. But actually various other historians are now popping up and saying he wasn't such a bad sort, because at least he did win us the Olympics and a few other things. And history will judge King Herod more kindly once another millennium or two has passed.
It's taken 2,000 years, and they found it in a place called Herodium.
Yes. Yes.
You think... You don't have to be Indiana Jones, do you? I know where we'll start.
It was in the name. But it is unkind, isn't it? It is unfair. He rebuilt Jerusalem. He was a great sponsor of, you know, you slaughter one generation of innocents, and that's all people remember you for. You know?
Yes, indeed. They have discovered King Herod in his body in the ancient town of Herodium. Herod was one of the richest rulers in the Roman Empire, going on to run a massive department store popular with tourists. Simon, who is asking, do you want lawsuits with that?
This is the really faintly ridiculous story that a pub, one of many which claims to be the highest in the country, altitude-wise, is being sued by Kentucky Fried Chicken because they have an item on their menu called the Family Feast, which you would have thought was a fairly generic sort of description, but apparently Kentucky Fried Chicken have successfully bought the copyright on that term, and their lawyers are watching. And so this hub, which only served the Family Feast at Christmas time, are being asked to change the name. And I do have some sympathy with the Kentucky Fried Chicken as an organisation protecting their names, because they, I mean, if you only have to wander up and down Stoke Newington High Street to see all these Louisiana fried cat's meat and, you know, deep fried southern racist chicken, Ku Klux Cluckers or whatever they're called. There are a lot of Me Too type organisations trying to cash in on the undeniably delicious secret blend of spices. But I think
blend
in this
of
case. Yes.
I'm sorry, but fat is not a spice.
Well, there's a feminist tome waiting to be written, isn't it? Anyway, yes, and they're thinking, the lawyers have offered to act for them free of charge, and I can't remember what they're called. It's not the Cat and the Fiddle, is it? But it's one of
the
those.
Tamhill Inn. Like that. There's this woman who's like, it's in the middle of nowhere, a rock outcrop in the Pennines, and she got this from, I think you should name and shame these lawyers. This is a man called Mr. Pratt of Freshfields in London, top city lawyers, who sent her a letter saying, we notice that once a year on Christmas Day you advertise Family Feast, a bit of turkey with all the trimmings. And by law, a Family Feast can only refer to a cardboard bucket full of Colonel Sanders' disgusting products and a large free bottle of fizzy pop of some kind. Anything else is illegal.
At the Tan Hill Inn, a pub on an unclassified road in the middle of moorland, 4 miles outside a tiny North Yorkshire hamlet, is being sued by KFC for infringement of their trademark for advertising their one-day-a-year Christmas lunch as a family feast. And in case anybody gets confused, the pub meal consists of a traditional Christmas dinner with all the trimmings and Christmas pudding, while the KFC family feast is a bucket of fried chicken, chips, coleslaw, potato gravy and a fizzy drink. I think when you've eaten that, the bucket comes in rather handy. Andy, why have men stopped thinking about scoring with the opposite sex?
Are we back to the same story as before?
It's scoring. It's similar. It's about scoring. What men think...
Oh, sorry, I was thinking about Chelsea. And that makes me normal. Because apparently, football fans think about their football club... Well, a lot of times a day, and I'm told that Chelsea fans, we think about our football team. We came third, I'm informed, in the league table of obsessive football fans. So it's rather like those polls you see about how often men think about sex, which is, I believe, once every... Sorry, I drifted off. One...
was it football or fornication? Where did it go?
It was sort of both, it's very odd.
Came first.
I think Francis said it was someone obscure.
Someone like Stockport,
I think. Stockport County. Yeah.
Accrington Stanley. Now, Manchester United were way down the table because their fans are very busy because they've got to think about the neighbourhood watch scheme in Reigate or Woking where they live.
And they've got to get to the factory in Bangalore, I think. That's where they live.
Actually, it was Sheffield United, and I don't even know what that is. But I, sadly... honestly, goodness, we've had this discussion before, Andy, because I know you're a football fan. I don't get it. They say it's the most stimulating of spectator sorts because it's unpredictable. What is unpredictable about it? Men run, they kick a ball, they pretend to fall over. It's not like anybody spontaneously combusts or turns into a peacock or something. That would be unpredictable. It's nothing unpredictable about it.
Well, you don't know what order they're going to do those things in. What you need to find then, Sandy, is an you play golf.
I do. Now, that is unpredictable.
Well, that's... you know the ball will go down the hole in the end. What is? No, I mean, that would if the hole could, if the hole could move and hide, and you didn't know where the hole was.
Okay,
then
it feels
would,
like it when you're playing. Anyway, according to a survey, who's got the time for these things, of 2,000 Premiership fans, the average football supporter thinks about the beautiful game once every 12 minutes during their waking hours. Now, I'm sure what they've done is they've confused the fans with Premiership footballers who literally only think once every 12 minutes. I think that's... Before we reveal the final scores, let's hear the cuttings the teams have brought along.
Francis. Handy. This is from the Times. A male stripper who performs in a police uniform has been charged with impersonating an officer. Stuart Kennedy, 24, was waiting to perform in Aberdeen when two female officers spoke to him. He said he was a stripper. They saw his act, then arrested him. He was charged with impersonating a police officer and carrying an offensive weapon.
Simon.
This is from the Round Town News, a personal column advertisement. Fully qualified topless erotic gents haircut offered by elegant, classy 35-year-old English lady. Offering ultimate pampering experience, also available sensual massage and sexy lingerie alone or with friend. Call Joanna for total discretion, easy to find. Call today for sexiest time and haircut ever. Haircut, not compulsory.
Andy.
Well, this is one that I think that Alan will enjoy. It's sent in by Keith Fuller. It's from the Harrogate Advertiser in 1911. There's a quote from the paper then about a round Britain air race in 1911. This is the contemporary account of it. The crowds were entertained by buskers and comedians until the cry went up, a plane! Sure enough, at 7 a.m. sharp, Jules Vedrine touched down on South Strait to the cheers of the crowd. But on discovering that he was French, he was disqualified. Four minutes and 26 seconds later, a second plane landed, piloted by André Beaumont. And to the intense annoyance of the assembled dignitaries, the second flyer was also found to be French, so he too was immediately disqualified.
Alan.
Well, I've got one to appeal to you, Sandy, because it's very rare I have a Scandinavian frisson to my cutting. It's from the Brighton Argus. And it says, to avoid offending the international Muslim community, King Carl Gustaf of Sweden has changed the name of his dog from Ali to Charlie.
Right, let's take a look at the final score. Francis and Simon have got 14, but this week's winners are Alan and Andy with 15 points. Before we leave you, here is some serious news reporting sent in by Hazel Wilkinson.
Iraq was left reeling last week by a spate of violence that included the worst terrorist atrocity since the US-led invasion of 2003.
And with that, goodbye.
Taking part in the news quiz were Francis Ween, Simon Evans, Andy Hamilton and Alan Corrin. In the chair was Sandy Toksvig, and the news is read by me, Peter Donaldson. The chair's script is written by Lucy Clark, Simon Littlefield and Danielle Ward. The producer was Ed Morris. ¶¶